Matthew 7, 24. The heading in this NIV, isn't it? New International Version, yeah, is The Wise and Foolish Builders. Bob the Builder came to mind, but we won't go there, but it's a very practical illustration that Christ encourages us to think about. Verse 24 onwards. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice, is what this means, is like the foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house. And of course, it fell with a great crash. None of us want that to happen to our house, whatever house we're talking about, and we ask God's blessing on those words.
Well, once more, I'd extend a warm welcome to everyone, and welcome to the house of the Lord, and to our time with God's word. And my prayer is that as we open it, that his spirit will illuminate it for us, and bring us understanding. And yeah, thank you, Pastor Rod, for the children's story. So, yeah, that's I don't remember know if you remember that one, but no. Well, maybe I could preach another sermon that you shared with us 35 years ago. But you know, it's important. We never know what effect our words will have. And that's why we need to take each word seriously. It can have a big impact. So my title this morning is The Disciple, How to Move Beyond Nominal Christianity. And why I'm sharing this with you, it's part of our series on the Gospel of Matthew. And what I've been sharing with is in the Gospel of Matthew, essentially, it's the story of King Jesus coming back to Israel and wanting to assert his rightful place as Israel's king, but Israel essentially say no thank you. And so he comes not just as a king, but as a prophet. We looked at that this morning. And what is the message of a prophet? Repent and be baptized, or repent, turn round, come back to me. Seek the Lord and you will find him. Knock and the door will be opened. This is prophetic language, inviting Israel to return to her Lord. This afternoon, we'll look at the righteous person, which is really going to be an expansion on what we did last week at the Day of Fellowship. But now I would like to talk to you about disciples, what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Now, in terms of the nation, why do we need disciples? And the reason is that if you only convert the shepherds of a nation, you end up with lots of sheep who just go through life oblivious of what Christianity is all about. And essentially, that's what we've had in many, many nations throughout history. You baptize the king, but the people just carry on in their way. And we end up with nominal Christians. It's rather like when I was growing up in Hull in the 1980s. We were either Hull Kingston Rover fans, red and white, or we were Hull FC fans, black and white. What are you? I'm Catholic, I'm C of E. Oh, and how often do you go to church? Not really. It's nominal Christians, where we say we're a Christian, but actually we're de facto not really practicing. And so this is why we need an emphasis on discipleship. It forces the principles of the king through the whole nation. And this is what I would like to share with you this morning. It is discipleship that makes sure that the nation as a whole understands the deeper things of God. Now, we have discipleship language, I need to turn over here, all the way through the gospel. The end of the gospel finishes in Matthew 28. The 11 disciples, and the term in Greek is mathetai. It comes from the verb to teach. And when you think of disciples, the problem is that we essentially just think of a disciple as someone, one of the 12 who followed Jesus, some unique group, but not so. You can do a search of the word mathetai in your Greek texts, and you will see it pops up again and again and again. It is simply the word student or pupil. So, you know, we can reread these texts and maybe remove some of what we think of are primarily religious terms, and actually they are common terms of the day. Now, the 11 students, the 11 pupils, yeah, whatever word we could use, went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubted. And then he gives them this command. Go therefore and it's the same word, mathetoisate, mathetai, mathetoisate, and make disciples of all nations. And one element of this is teaching them all things. So we are to be both students and, if we're going to teach others, what does that make us? Teachers. So, in English educational terms, it is lifelong learning. Yeah, when I was at Newbold, this was the jingo that we were always taught by, always shared with us by University of Wales. And you see it, saw it in all the educational literature, promoting lifelong learning. So we are both students who learn, but we're also teachers at the same time. Yeah, this is the goal of what it means to be a disciple, not somebody who simply learns, but somebody who also teaches. Now, let me just share for 2 or 3 minutes. In the ancient world, what did it mean to be a student? Yeah. You see, every nation has its own educational philosophy. That's what I've learned. When I was at Newbold, we taught Andrew's degrees. Now, they never ever asked us what we were doing. It was a free ride. And then we had University of Wales degrees, University of Wales Lampeter. They were crawling all over us like flies crawl over whatever, yes? But they were intensely monitoring us, had a very, very clear idea of what education was about. In American education, it's about broad knowledge. You got to know a lot about many, many things. But then you've only got the same number of hours in the day as a British student. So if you're going to learn a lot about a lot, how deep is your knowledge? Fairly shallow. The British system is the opposite. It says you learn a lot about a little, but now you go very, very deep. Yeah. So I know a lot about a little, but then as I have to tell my students, they would be amazed at how ignorant I am if only they talked to me more. Yeah. They would find out that there's these huge gaps in my knowledge, things which simply because of the British education system, we specialise very early. And then you can go to Croatia, Germany, all around the world. Each country has its particular educational philosophy. And what I've learned is that every country thinks its education system is the best in the world. Yes? So, you know, after you've seen a number of them, you realise that actually, what are we doing? It's like my mother, you know, she's an Irish daughter of an Irish farmer. And what my Irish granddad taught me is that there's 1,000 ways to skin a rabbit. And there is 1,000 ways to educate a child, a young person, a young man, a middle-aged lady. The problem is that education is hard. It's hard to educate us. There's something which resists learning. If it were easy, we wouldn't need to go to school for so long. But it's hard. So we have to stick at it. I think of education as a prison sentence. Yes, it's that's what I share with the students. You know, American education is like going to prison. You know, if you've been in it for 8 years, you get a master's. If you've been in it for another 8 years, 16 years, you get a doctorate. Yeah, it's like serving time. Yes? But education is difficult. There's something within us that resists change. Now, that's good, but it also makes it hard to learn. Now, education in the ancient world. Let me just give you a brief overview of what it is, and then we'll move to our gospel. In general, your education was very simple. Whatever your dad did, you do. Whatever your mum did, you did. So if your dad was a carpenter, guess what you're going to be? A carpenter. What was Joseph? A carpenter. Now, actually, the word in Greek is technon. It's more than a carpenter. It's a builder. Yeah? So Jesus, he wasn't just sawing wood all day. He was probably a bit of a mason. And just 5 or 6 miles from Nazareth, where he grew up, there was a Greco-Roman city called Sepphoris, and historians suggest that that's probably where Jesus worked, building this city. So he did what his dad did. Now we call this home education. Yes, and the richer guys, they could have their kids with them, just watching them, and you learn by imitating me. So that's how it was. What your dad did, you did. If your mum was a baker, you were a baker. If she was a seamstress, you became a seamstress. That's how the ancient world functioned. Now, if you had some money, you might send your kids along to school. And they would go to usually a small dark room with a teacher there. And some of our sources say, don't send your kids in the dark in case the teacher hurts your kids. There was a great deal of mistrust of teachers. Why? Because teachers knew that the only way to teach a student was through a technique which, by and large, we've given. It's long and thin like this, and a bit flexible. Yeah, this was the secret to teaching in the ancient world. Yeah, you can guess what I'm talking about. Yes, and for some reason we've given up this great motivational tool. Yes, but this was how they taught. It was really through drumming into students by rote large bodies of literature. They would learn to read and write, and then they would be taught sections of the classics, and they would just spend their days memorizing and repeating, memorizing and repeating. Now, when your dad and mum ran out of money, which is usually by the time you got to about 11 or 12, at that point you joined your dad or your mum in their business. No more education. There was no such thing as a state school. Yeah. Have you ever wondered what the word school means? It comes from a Greek word, school. Yeah, it comes from the word skolazo, which means to have leisure or spare time. To have leisure. Oh, I've got nothing to do today. Where am I? At school. Got nothing to do. I'm as free as a bird. Where am I? At school. You see, most kids were like my great-grandfather, which hasn't been mentioned yet, but I'm sure we can wheedle them in somewhere to one of the introductions. Yeah, one of the first Vine to become an Adventist, because he went to school down in Bournemouth till he was 12, at which point he left, and at that point he became an engineer's mate, and he spent the rest of his childhood climbing through metal tunnels, cleaning them, scrubbing them in heating systems in the dark. I mean, I can't imagine going into these dark, pitch black tunnels, and that's what he spent his time doing as a kid. Yeah. But that was the norm. The Roman state had no interest in educating over 12s. Why do we need an educated population? You educate them, what are they going to do? Grumble. Make trouble. Now, just let them get on with their jobs. And that was by far the norm throughout the ancient world. If you were lucky, you went to school till roughly the age of 12, at which point you joined your parents in their business. The only group who carried on at school were the 1%, the sons, the odd daughter, but by and large, the sons of the elite of the elite. They could afford it. See, They had servants to do everything. So they could go to school. What did we say school means? Leisure. You see, you know, if you've got somebody else providing lunch for you, you don't need to work in the fields. You can sit around and discuss great ideas. So only the rich of the rich went to college or the equivalent of university. So you think of Socrates. Now, Socrates was maybe the father of a stonemason. We're not quite sure. But his two students, well-known students, Plato, you've heard of Plato, an aristocrat. Another of Socrates' well-known students, Xenophon, an aristocrat. Plato taught Aristotle, the son of the king of Macedonia's doctor. So high up, grew up in the palace, mixing with the elite. Aristotle became the teacher of Alexander the Great, the king of Macedonia. So our examples from the ancient world that we know of those who go on to what we would say is higher education is purely education of the elite. Yeah. They got time. That's why school is so nice. Isn't it nice to go to school? Yeah, children, be glad you're going to school, because otherwise we'd have you down the pits. Yeah. Proper kids work, eh? No, we'll send them off where they can just sit around in the warmth, being entertained by Mr. or Mrs. Teacher. So we come to the Gospel of Matthew. In Luke, Matthew 4, and we've got a remarkable story for the ancient world. Verse 18, Jesus, as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. He said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." Immediately they left their nets and followed him, and as they went on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, in the boat with their father Zebedee, mending their nets, and he called them. Immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. So what were Andrew and Peter doing? Fishing. What were James and John doing? Working the nets. But what are they? Fishermen. And who do they work for? Their father. I mean, how long have they been working as fishermen? Since they were this high. Have they been to college? No. University? No. And then along comes this guy and he says, "Follow me." This is an invitation to become a student, a pupil. And do they say, "Oh, well, no, not for me, mate"? What's their response? This is the offer of a lifetime. Only the elite get this. Now, maybe in Israel, it was the academic elite, but they're being given the offer to go beyond 12-year-old education. They jump up. Wow. And here is the first point I want to share with you, is that when you read the Gospel of Matthew, you are reading the equivalent of today's university education. You are reading the story of a professor called a didaskalos, a teacher, but really it's a adult teacher teaching other adults, and in the ancient world that is our equivalent of highest of the high education. So you start reading this literature, this educational literature of adults being educated, and what is it going to do to your mind? Christianity has this amazing ability of lifting the way we think. Christianity says that we need to educate the populace. Can these guys afford traditional higher education? No. And this is something, you know, we live in secular society where we assume everybody should be educated. That is a Christian foundation that they have inherited. In the ancient world, only the kids went to school, if they were lucky. We offer education to everyone. That is the influence of Christianity on our nation. And it is a great heritage, and one which I pray they maintain. So, there is a little introduction. Here we are reading in the Gospel, university elite education. But it is being blown open, access is being blown open to the sons and daughters of fishermen. That tells us something about the teacher. He believes that whatever he has is not just for a small elite, the rulers, but he wants this for the entire population. He wants us all to join his university. So, there's my introduction. Basically, I suffer from far too much material in my presentations, but there we go. Let me share with you 3 points. How did learning occur? How did Jesus teach? Secondly, what makes a good or bad teacher? How do we know whether Jesus is a teacher worth learning from? And then thirdly, what makes a good student as against a bad student? Yeah. How can we ensure that as students of Professor Jesus, that we are actually good students? Now, there is a question which has bugging me as I was doing my walk along St. Mary's, whatever it is. St. Mary?
Lady.
Lady. Why don't I get Saint? Yeah. I need to go back and change the sign so it reads St. Mary. Yeah. But anyway, St. Mary, there we go. I need a teacher. But anyway, Ladies Mary. The thought is bugging me. You know, after all is said and done, why does God think it necessary that we go through this educational process? What is he trying to achieve in our lives? Yeah. So, first question, how did learning occur? How did teachers teach? Yeah, and here is a summary of how teachers taught in the ancient world, regardless of your level, from low education to high level education. It occurred roughly the same way whether you lived in Sparta, in Athens, in Jerusalem, in Rome. It was by and large the same. There were some nuances between the various areas, but by and large, this was ancient education, and it's the foundation for the gospel. Here we go. A teacher speaks words. What does the student do with those words? They hear the words and they memorize them. So the teacher speaks. So we've got, we teach through word and deed. The teacher speaks and the student hears and memorizes. The teacher lives out what he speaks through deed and action. And the student watches what the teacher is doing and imitates it. In essence, that's how education worked. And here is the thing, is that as I've been doing my studies on ancient education, I scratch my head and think, okay, I'm paid to educate future disciples, makers, to prepare future pastors. on the news this week, I learnt that the seminary where I teach is the 10th biggest seminary in North America. That's something to give thanks to God for. Yeah, we're the 10th biggest, and we're half the size of number one. Yeah, and we are increasing, which is good news. So I look at what I do, and you'll probably think that, do I have any problems speaking? No. I'm like a tape player, yeah? You just press play and blah, 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 out it comes. Okay? So I can, out it comes. I can speak, yes? Now, whether it makes any sense is another question, yeah? But to teach, I also need to demonstrate what I'm teaching in my life. I need to give a pattern for my students to imitate. So let's just talk about each of these just for a minute or two. Jesus is described in the Gospel of Luke as a prophet who is mighty in deed and word. That's educational code to tell us that he's a good teacher. He not only speaks, but he acts. He's a good teacher. Okay. So, here is the first point. When a teacher speaks, and I don't know whether I'm anywhere near achieving it this morning, but you need to keep things brief. Yes? And you think, well, if only. Yes, if only. Think of the sayings in the Gospel of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7. You are the, what did Jesus tell his disciples and the crowds? You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. Short, pithy sayings. Do not judge in order. How does it go? That you don't be judged yourself. So you teach by trying to synthesize everything you've thought, all those wonderful ideas, synthesize it in an image. That's the way to teach. Now, while you are with me, you can ask me questions and we can go through and I can explain it. Here is the problem, is that on Monday I fly away. You won't have me with you. Are you going to be able to ask questions on Monday? Not a chance. So the teacher's problem is this, is that I can speak words with you while I'm with you, but if I'm not with you, you've lost access to my wonderful wisdom. So, what do we have to do? As a good teacher, I need to make sure my words are short, pithy, and memorable. And I need to make sure you learn them off by heart so that when you're not with me and I'm not with you, in whatever situation you are, what should I do in this situation? Pastor Vine taught me to da-da-da-da. And it comes straight to mind. A bird in the hand is with two in the bush. Behind every great man there is, the version I had is, a frowning woman. We know these and they embody great principles. You read 1 Thessalonians. Paul does this all the time. Rejoice always. This is chapter 5 of Thessalonians. He's given them his great teaching and then essentially says, well, I'm a teacher, I'm teaching you, but I'm not going to be with you always. So these principles I want you to memorize. I want you to take on board these pithy sayings. So whatever situation you're in, you've always got my words in your head. You're never without me. I am your teacher, symbolically standing next to you, because I've drummed my ideas into your head. So you're never with me. You can't get me out of your head. Yeah? Just listen to this stuff. Rejoice always. It's better in Greek. It rhymes. It's easier to remember. Yeah? Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. Do not quench the spirit. Do not despise the words of prophets. Test everything. Hold fast to what is good. Abstain from every form of evil. I tried this when I was teaching at Newbold. When I would go for my evening walk with the dog, I memorize this passage and I would go through the day. Have I been practicing this? Now, that is one step towards being a good student. Really, every moment of the day, I should be asking if I'm going to act this way or say this. How is my teacher guiding me? What principle would Paul want me to implement? Same with Jesus. He gives us pithy short sayings all the way through the gospel. And he wants these to be in our heads so that we're never left without guidance. A teacher which leaves his students with no guidance simply doesn't care about his student. So, there we go. Keep things brief. Another great technique with your words is to gather material topically according to a defining principle or common theme. Matthew has done it, Sermon on the Mount, how to live, how to witness, what to share with others, how to live in the church, what happens in the future. He's gathered material topically. I am preaching you to you topically. This morning I did prophet. Today I'm doing disciple. Hopefully some of it may stick. Gather material topically. Another way in which you can make your words more memorable. Now, another technique is, and this is really the essence of ancient education, is constant repetition. There is one part of Jesus' teaching which he repeats and repeats and he repeats. What is it? Matthew 16, Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man, what's going to happen to the Son of Man? He's going to be betrayed, handed over, crucified, but on the third day rise again. And then we go to chapter 17, and what do we hear again? The Son of Man is going to be betrayed, handed over, beaten, crucified, and on the third day, rise again. And then in chapter 20, we are told the Son of Man is going to be beaten, betrayed, handed over, crucified, and on the third day, rise again. Do we get "you are the light of the world" three times in the gospel? No, once. Do we get "you are the salt of the world"? Hopefully I'm getting these correct. three times? No, once. This is repeated time and time again. What is Luke telling us about this particular teaching of Jesus? Important. Was it easy for them to understand? No, very, very difficult. He had to repeat and repeat and repeat. It's the hardest thing to teach, why the Son of Man had to go through what he did. That's what Matthew is signaling by repeating this. Jesus, we read in the Gospel of Matthew, is constantly on the walk. He's walking from Galilee, all around Galilee. He's walking to Tyre and Sidon, up to Caesarea Philippi, around the Decapolis. He's always walking. Who's walking with him? The disciples. What are they doing as they walk along? Are they A, discussing the weather, B, discussing the cricket, C, discussing Brexit, D, is he teaching them? We have to assume that when Jesus was walking with the disciples, he was doing what every other teacher did. We can look at the Greek philosophers. This is how they taught. They taught on the move. You are the light of the world. What did I just tell you? Come on, disciples, what have I just told you? You are the light of the world. Come on, disciples, I've just tried it. You are the what? Okay, that's beautiful around here. Come on, are you a bit tired? Now, what did I just tell you 5 minutes ago? You are? Okay, and Jesus carries on walking. Oh, it's time for a drink break. Now, guys, what did I teach you? What am I teaching you today? You are? Constant repetition. This is why, when you compare Mark with Matthew, when you look at the teachings of Jesus in Mark and the teachings of Jesus in Matthew in Greek, they are almost word for word the same. But when you look at the narratives, maybe Jesus casts out the demoniac. In Mark, it's this long, but in Matthew, it's half the length. And lots of variation in the stories. But when it comes to his teachings, you compare Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and his words are almost identical. It tells us how he taught, through constant repetition. So, if the teacher speaks, what does the student do? Hears. But not just hears, what was the other thing they need to do? They have to memorize. Now, how good is your memory? Pretty hopeless. Yeah. That's why we've devolved our memory into what we call books. Yeah. You know, the ancients were dead against books. They say if you write things down, what is it going to do? It's going to make you lazy. Yeah, it's just education went downhill from the moment we started writing books. Yeah. Really, you should know everything in your head. And this is what we find. We find the rabbis taught their pupils to recite from memory not only Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They boasted, our 12-year-olds know the whole thing by heart. At that point, I realized how uneducated I would appear to an ancient. Jesus would look at me and say, oh, we've got this one source where a rabbi couldn't remember a particular verse. And he is told not to go back to university, not back to college, not back to school, but back to kindergarten. If he couldn't remember the verse, where do you learn that stuff? Kindergarten. And all the way through education, you are memorizing, repeating, memorizing and repeating. We've got one story of a rabbi who was thrown in jail with no windows. He knew the time of day because he knew that as he recited the Torah from memory, he knew that at 11 o'clock he was at this point in the Torah. That's how he could tell the time. Phenomenal. Simon Lackey repeated his Mishnah. This is the traditions of the elders, which Jesus talks about and says you don't really need to know. Mishnah paragraph 40 times before presenting himself before his teacher. Another one here repeats it 24 times. These are students. Yeah, have you learnt your stuff? Got to memorize it. Got to know it. Memorize. Yeah. I was amazed when I went to Poland as a student missionary. We've got some Poles here. Who else is Polish? Who's your parents? Yeah. There, very good. I was amazed because my friends there knew stuff from memory. I mean, you know, who is our greatest writer in England? Shakespeare. Now, my knowledge of Shakespeare is about one line. Can you guess which it is? Whoa. From a different generation. To be. Or not to be. I can't even remember the ending. Yes? I went to Poland and, you know, Sabbath evening at the seminary, what are we going to do? Okay, they start entertaining themselves with games, and then we get onto songs, and then we get onto poetry, and they stand up, these guys my age, and start going on. Adam Mickiewicz, he's the great Polish poet, national poet. And they would go on 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just rattling it off. And I was thinking, goodness, these are Ubermenschen. You know, these are supermen and women. How on earth do they do that? Different educational climate. Yeah. And this is what is expected. To be a good student, you're expected to memorize. Yeah? And only later in your educational experience do you ask questions and ask, what is it that I'm speaking? let's move on to words, deeds. So a good teacher would offer a life that was worthy of imitation. The philosophers, in the morning, they would teach the students their words. But then in the afternoon, they would say, look, guys, what does this mean in practice when we live it out? You know, I've taught you this wonderful stuff, but if it makes no difference in your life, how much is it actually worth? Not much. Nobody valued pure theory in the ancient world. The philosophers taught physics, what is, logic, how to know what is, and lastly, ethics, how to live. Those were the three areas the philosophers taught. They always ended up with ethics. And it is the basic assumption that if I share something with you, at the end of the day, if it makes no difference how you live, then I've wasted your time. So, we've got throughout, this is just Philo and Josephus. I'm going to skip through some of these, but you can see them on the recording later. But they lift up Moses, not just for his great teachings, but for the fact that he provided a life. His deeds are worth imitating. You would read ancient literature, Homer. Why? It's got some great characters, not just for entertainment, but role models that you can build your life upon. Everybody in the ancient world was looking for a role model. Who are you imitating? And this comes into Paul. This is not just with the gospel. You know, when we read the story of Jesus throughout the gospel, essentially we are being told, his deeds and his words, and he's inviting us to imitate him. Paul says, be imitators of me as I imitate Christ. We should have the confidence to be able to say, if you want to be a Christian, listen to what I say and copy what I do. You want to be a Christian? Oh, it's easy. Just copy me. Now, how do you feel when I say that? Big Ed? No? That's how education worked in the ancient world. Listen to my words and imitate my deeds. This is how teachers taught. And you, he's talking to the believers in Thessalonica, have become imitators of us and of the Lord. And in spite of persecution, you received the word with joy, inspired by the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia. He's telling them, you guys have imitated me, but now what have you become? An example for the church in Dunfermline. And they are copying Creve Church. As you copy me, and as I copy the Lord. Everybody's imitating everybody else. And educational philosophy is throughout 1 Thessalonians. Paul, he gives us one word. It's nowhere else in the ancient world. He's made this one up. Theodidaktoi. Theos, theology, God. Didaktoi, taught. You are God taught. He teaches in the same way. So, there we have it. How do we teach? What are the two mediums? I teach through my words and through my deeds. As a teacher, I speak, and what are you going to do? Listen and, the hard part, memorize. And then you're going to watch me, my deeds, and you're going to imitate. That's how we teach in the ancient world. So let's ask a question. What makes a good or bad teacher within this system? And we've got good and bad teachers throughout the Gospel of Matthew. You should be asking, is Jesus a good teacher? Is he worth me spending my life, reorienting my life to listen to his words and to imitate him? Well, what do you think a bad teacher is? According to this system, if I'm going to teach through my words and through my deeds, what do you think a bad teacher would be? A hypocrite. What is a hypocrite? What's happening between my words and deeds? They don't match. And this is what we find. A bad teacher, Matthew 23, verse 3, Jesus addresses them in Matthew 23 and He's recognizing them as teachers. Then Jesus said to the crowds and his students, his disciples, the scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. That means they're teaching. Therefore, do whatever they teach you. So their words are good. Where are they getting their words from? They're sitting on Moses' seat. They're getting their words from Moses. So do whatever they teach you and follow it, but do not do as they do. For... And here's the criticism. Here's how to identify a bad teacher. They do not practice what they teach. So there you have, in essence, what a bad teacher is. It's somebody who, there's a disjunct between what they profess and what they actually do in practice. There you have your bad teachers. Now, if that's a bad teacher, what is a good teacher? Someone whose deeds match their words. And so we need to read the Gospel of Matthew. And if I can run over, oh, we've got it here. Same thing as we've got on our board here. But throughout the Gospel of Matthew, we've got chapters full of Jesus' words. These are the word section where you can have a long, long dialogue. Okay? Matthew 5 to 7. If you read it, how long is it going to take you? I remember when I was pastoring in Derby, have you seen those videos where they actually act out the Gospel of Matthew? And there's one on the Gospel of John and one on Acts. Well, I pray, played the Sermon on the Mount. And you would think that Jesus, now as a teacher, this is how I should be preaching. Yeah, I would stand to read the lesson, but then I would sit to teach. This is how I should be talking to you this morning as an ancient teacher. And you should be sitting at my feet. Yeah, but this is how I should be doing it. But when you watch the film, yeah, Jesus, he has to keep their attention. He's doing cartwheels. He's jumping from rock to rock. I thought, that is about as historically far from the truth as it could have been. Yeah, but, you know, this is what Matthew has done. He's gathered loads of words together. And then in between, we get his deeds. So this is the exercise, your homework for the next, well, I'm going to be back here in 8 years. When I come back, is I want you to compare Jesus' words with his deeds, and his deeds with his words. Now, let's start simply. You've got 5 sermons here, so you're going to memorize all those 5 sermons, and then you're going to start reading what Jesus does in between his sermons, and you're going to start thinking, do they match? If they do, what conclusion do we come to? He's a good teacher. He's not a hypocrite. He's someone who, when I look at him, he's consistent. We live in an age where we're suspicious of people in power because they tell us one thing and do another. I would offer you to you, Teacher Jesus, and I would suggest that when you listen to his words and watch his deeds, that there is a consistency there. There is ethical purity there. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house or town. Did Jesus put this into practice? Yes, he did. When Jesus heard this about the death of John, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. Time and time again, when people reject him, he doesn't punch them on the nose. He simply backs away, puts into practice what he preaches. Beware of them, for they will hand you over to councils and flog you in their synagogues, and you will be dragged before governors and kings because of me as a testimony to them and the nations. Does he give a testimony? Yes, he does. Does he go through what he's expecting of his students? Yes, he does. He himself is dragged before the chief priests and elders, and he is bound and led away and handed over to Pilate and the governor. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. You remember the story when his mum and his son, brothers and daughters came outside the house where he was preaching. He's gone mad. Tell him to come out. And what did Jesus say? My mother and my brothers and my sisters are those who listen to me and follow what I say and keep the will of my Father in heaven, to paraphrase. So he knows that he has a higher allegiance. So we can go through. Those are just 3 examples. But this is what I want you to do as you start reading again. Gospel of Matthew, read it with your educational glasses on. You're listening to the words and you're watching the deeds and you're asking, are they consistent? How does one explain the other? How does the other explain the one? He lives a consistent life. This is what it means to be a good teacher. But here's another implication of this. How can I share my deeds with you unless I live with you? In the ancient world, this is where I wonder, and I think I was a better teacher at Newbold than I am at Andrews. For the simple reason, I had time for my students. Now, at Andrews, I have learned a huge amount. Yeah, and I praise God. I look back now, I've been there 4 years. When I went there, I was a bit annoyed with the Lord. I did not want to go. I really didn't. Okay? And it wasn't just the lack of decent fish and chips. Yeah. Cornish pasties. Yes. I've checked the house prices here. Yeah. And I felt angry, but I've also, praise God now, I have had time to study and study and learn and learn, and I pray that will be a blessing for the global church. Yeah. So I thank the Lord for that now. I look back and just say, okay, God works in ways which sometimes you just do not understand. Yeah. But at Newbold, my door could be open. You'd have 20 in a class. You knew everybody's name. You could have them home for Sabbath lunch. You imagine we've got 750 students just in the seminary. Got classes of 50, 60 students. Are you going to learn all their names? No. Am I going to be able to share my time with every one of those 60 students? Not a chance. Multiply it by three classes, that's 180 students I'm teaching each semester. How? This is the thing I wrestle with, because I don't view myself as a professor. I view myself as someone who's involved in pastoral education, shaping the next generation of pastors. And if I can't practice the biblical model, who is going to practice it? I have to be able to become vulnerable. I have to say, look, you want to know what I share, my philosophy is, my understanding of Christianity? This is how it makes a difference in my life. Let's see. What does Paul say? He says in, I've got it down here somewhere. 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. He says, so deeply do we care for you that we determine to share with you not only the gospel of God, so there's the word element, but also our own selves, because you have become very dear for us. Paul there in 1 Thessalonians 2 verse 8 is basically saying, I did my best to be a good teacher. I shared the word, so there's the speaking bit, but I shared my life with you. It means that true Christian education requires contact. It requires time with others. You can't do this thing on your own. It's a community venture. That's the implication. We need to spend time with our teacher, not just in the classroom, but outside of the classroom. Christian discipleship is about sharing our whole lives, our whole life with someone else. And you think, how do we do that in practice? That is our challenge that we face. Third and last point. So we've seen how learning occurred. I teach through two mediums. What are the two mediums? I'm teaching you this very moment. What was the first medium? I speak, and what do you guys do? Listen and memorize. And then I also deed, act. And what are you going to do? You're going to copy me. The Greek word is mimeomai. What does that sound like? Mimic. You mimic me. Yeah. So that's how we teach. What makes a good teacher? Someone whose deeds match their words. So let's finish by asking what makes a good student. A good student. Yeah. Now, what we have are examples all through the gospel, especially in this latter half of the gospel, these chapters here. We've got story after story, and time's against us, but let me at least share one with you. Let's turn to Matthew 14, 1 to 12. And here is another reading strategy I want to suggest to you, is that as you're reading these stories, this is a story of certain actions occurring. I want you to compare this story with what you know Jesus has already taught earlier in the gospel, in particular in the Sermon on the Mount. These are examples of what happens when you fail to put into practice what Jesus teaches. So, let me read the story, and then I want you to tell me, what does it remind you of from the Sermon on the Mount? At that time, Herod, the ruler, heard reports about Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers are at work in him." For Herod had arrested John, bound him, and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been telling him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." Though Herod wanted to put him to death, He feared the crowd because they regarded him as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company, and she pleased Herod so much that he promised on oath to grant her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter." The king was grieved, yet out of regard for his oaths and for the guests, he commanded it to be given. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison. The head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and who brought it to her mother. "Happy birthday," she said. His disciples came and took the body and buried it, and then they went and told Jesus. You read that story, and it's not just a story of a brutal execution. And last year, I actually went to the place where Herod was held prison. You know, we know where it was. But this is a story which is embodying what happens when you fail to put into practice the words of Jesus. Did you notice any allusions between this story and the Sermon on the Mount? Now, I know we haven't gone through the Sermon on the Mount, but would anybody hazard a guess? Anything in here that Herod says or does which contradict the teachings of Jesus?
Don't make any vows.
Don't make any vows. Excellent one. Jesus says in Matthew 5, do not make vows. Instead, let your yes be yes and your no be no. But what does he do? He makes a rash promise and then he feels he has to keep it. What else in this story reminds you of Jesus' teaching? He does, doesn't he? He's a weasel. Yeah. He likes popularity. In order, Jesus talks about the hypocrites who do things in order to be seen. He wants to be popular. Very good one. What else? Don't hate your enemies, but love them. Okay, and here, what profession was John the Baptist? A prophet. A baptizer. Yeah, strange. You know, we could explain why we call him the baptizer, but he is a prophet. What does Herod do to him? Kills him. Does Jesus talk about persecuted prophets? Yes, he does. When he watches his stepdaughter dancing, what's his reaction? He likes her. Who is his stepdaughter's mother? Should she be his wife? No. What has he done? He's nicked his brother's wife. Does Jesus talk about divorce, adultery, lust? Yes, he does. We can go through this story. He commits adultery and lusts. He wants to commit murder. He makes a promise. He persecutes a prophet. There's almost nothing in this story which isn't in the Sermon on the Mount. You read the story and you think, boy, I've heard all this before. Yeah. We could go through, I'm not going to go through this, but you could go through, start with the rich young ruler. Yeah. He keeps the commandments. Jesus talks about the commandments. He needs to stop worrying about wealth. Jesus tells us that in chapter 6. He needs to store treasure in heaven. We're told that in chapter 6. So Matthew is giving us stories through his gospel which illustrate what happens when you fail to put into practice the words of Jesus. And we're meant to read this and think, oh, my goodness, I need to take his words more seriously, because when you ignore them, look what happens. So let's finish with what makes a good student. And this was our scripture reading. Everyone who hears these, what? Words. So Jesus has been teaching. He's been sharing his words. Everyone who hears these words of mine and doesn't just hear them and memorize them, but does what? Acts upon them. You see, you move from simply hearing to copying. This is educational language. Who acts upon them will be like a wise man who built his house upon the rock. But the foolish man, everyone who hears these words, so they've sat through the lecture, but then they wander out and it makes zero difference to how they behave. And does not act on them, will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Now, both of them are building. Both of them are listening. The difference is that the foolish man listens, but then he builds his house according to a different plan. The wise man listens, and he says, that plan for my life that you have for me, embodied in your teachings, that identity that you want me to adopt, all those words, I'm going to put them in practice, and those will ensure that my life, my house, is built on a secure foundation. One final passage, educational section of the gospel. For it is as if a man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Now, growing up, I was led, probably erroneously, to believe that a talent is what? A natural ability. Oh, and my poor mum, she would go out and clean houses to raise money to put me through piano lessons. Oh, and the Lord has given you an ability to play the piano, Cedric. The problem was that after a hard day at school, well, actually, it wasn't hard, because what was I doing at school? Leisure. Yeah, time off from the pits. Yeah. So I was enjoying myself at school and I was coming home, and what should I have really done some hard work, but for some strange reason, I would come home and think, Conrad, why don't we go outside and play some cricket, football, bit of rugby, let's do something. Oh, and my music teacher says, Cedric, when you get home, relax with the piano. And my mum, my dad, Cedric, God has given you this gift. Yeah. And I say, well, I wish it was a bit bigger, this gift that he gave me. Because I see it with my 2 boys. Now, you have to turn this off in case my wife hears me. She'll kill me if she hears me. But my older boy ain't musical. My younger boy, yeah, he's got rhythm. Yeah, it's like I went into a laundrette in Lambeth, in London, and the laundrette was going around like this, and there was this little black kid came up, and he was dancing to the rhythm of the laundrette. And I thought, in a million years, I'd never be able to get those moves right. Yeah. Jesus is not talking about your natural abilities when he's saying, I've given you 5 talents, I've given you 2 talents, I've given you one talent. What has Jesus left his disciples when he leaves them? He says, what are you to pass on to the nations? Teach them what? What I have commanded you. What I have taught you. The talents we are given from Jesus are his words. And the challenge is to take his words and to multiply them. And what does it mean to multiply them? It can be 2 things. One is to take them further. Paul knows that student always stands on the shoulders of the teacher and takes the teacher's teaching further. That's what a good student does. But at the same time, we can also say you multiply them by living out those teachings in your life. So, good student not only hears, but imitates and acts and takes the teachings of his teacher and replicates them in his life. To conclude, discipleship requires memorization. I know we don't do it and we have everything. I have 5,000, maybe up to 6,000-7,000 books just on my little iPhone. Do I know it? No. I've got so many books I don't even know which ones I've got. Great library, useless if it's not here. I hear the words of Jesus, and what do I need to do? Memorize. How long does memorization take? Long time. I need to spend more time in his word. just listening to his words. I need to memorize, repeat them, and then slowly they percolate into me. When his word dwells within us, our thought world changes. You know, why is Jesus interested in suddenly having students everywhere? It's because he looks at us and he looks at Israel and he says, your problem is lawlessness. Inside, you're dirty. How am I going to clean up your inner life? By putting good words in, and let those words multiply and eventually dominate the soundtracks in your mind, so it pushes out that dirt, those evil desires, that lawlessness. And then once we've changed your inside, what's going to happen to your deeds? If I can change you from a bad tree to a good tree, he uses that in Matthew 7. If I can change you from what the tree is inside, what's going to happen to the fruit? It's going to start producing good fruit. It's going to start producing fruit which will be a blessing to others. It's going to start producing fruit which will land on the tongues of others and just blow their minds away. This is education. It's what I've just shared with you. It blows my mind because it tells me that every word I say, every deed I do, has to be shaped by my teacher. It's not just the 28 fundamental beliefs. I know them. This is discipleship at a whole other level. I have to spend time with my teacher. Now, he's not with me by my side, but in the text, my Jesus sits next to me and teaches me. I listen to his words and I observe his actions. And my invitation to you this morning is that you are all students, whether you know it. The question is whether you are exposing yourself to good teachers. And from personal experience, Jesus is a good teacher. He's consistent. He cares about you. He has your best interests at heart. And I offer him the same invitation he offered to James and John and Peter and Andrew. Follow me. Let's go to Cambridge. Let's go to Oxford. Let's go to Aberdeen. Let's go to Edinburgh University. And live at the feet of Jesus. This is my invitation this morning. To his name be glory and honor and praise. Amen.